in the seventh. That's right, we're on seventh episode now of season two. I am psyched to be with you, Dr. Kelly Dunler. Kelly is a licensed clinical therapist, lecturer, public speaker, community manager, and, oh, you know, a game designer as well. With more accreditations than most people have had hot dinners, it is a surprise to no one that Kelly is a supreme expert. Kelly is also one of the leading experts on video games and mental health, and in discussing the sort of practical applications of ethical game design. We chat about all this and more in this episode. It was something else, if I'm being honest. You hear it, but like, big fanboy of Kelly, and it's great. I really think you'll enjoy this one. Couple of little content warnings. We do talk about mental health, so we talk about some ill mental health challenges. So there are a couple of sort of words that some people might find upsetting, and I think there's a smidge of strong language, or at least very passionate language. So do please be aware of that. Take care of yourself. Remember that you can access resources online and wherever you found this episode. Anyway, take care, and I hope you enjoy it. Hello there, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Psyched to Be With You. It is, I forget which episode we're at this point. I forget what month it's going to be by the time this goes out, but that's just because of the magnitude of the guest that is joining me on this episode that has sent my entire anatomy in a spin. I'm incredibly excited. This is going to be a special one. I know you all think, Chris, you say this at the top of every episode. Partly because it's true, but secondly because this one is super mega fudge coated awesome. With that, I will let you introduce myself, but I am very psyched to be with you. I said the thing. Please introduce yourself. Tell us who you are, what you do.
Sure. I mean, I feel like I was introduced like a black hole, and I've never had that happen before. So I'm psyched to be here too. My name is Dr. Kelly Dunlap. I am a licensed and practicing clinical psychologist. I am also the head of community at Take This, which is a mental health nonprofit dedicated to the mental health and wellness of game players and game developers. And I also occasionally sometimes use my master's in game design when I teach game design at American University in Washington, D.C. to some lovely grad students there. And, you know, when time allows, I actually sometimes get to make and or play games. Not as often as I would like, but that is, you know, you always need something that you're striving for. So that's me.
Yeah, definitely. Strive is good, right? Rather be busy than bored.
Yes, absolutely. Let's
just break that down a little bit, because there was a lot to digest there. So
unpack that.
Clinical psychologist. Yeah.
Yes. That means I have a doctorate in clinical psychology, okay. And I am licensed in practicing.
So that's one degree, okay. Then you mentioned a master's in game design.
Yes.
Just casual, as you do. Yeah.
I mean, doesn't everybody?
Then teaching, some type of teaching qualification in there as well?
No.
No? Okay.
That's the beautiful thing about having a doctorate is if you have a doctorate, people just think you can teach. So.
Okay. No one tell nothing. Okay. Keep that on the DS. Fine.
Nope. Keep that on the download here.
And community management.
Yes.
Some people would describe that as a lot.
Some people would. I like to describe it as integrated eclectic.
Ooh.
Largely, there's a lot of overlap. So before I went to doctor school, I actually ran an esports community in Halo for a sport type called Griffball. And I ran the community there of Griffball Hub. And I did that for almost 10 years. So that was pre-doctoral and during doctoral a bit as well. And so, you know, my research areas as a student was in games and mental health at the undergraduate and at the graduate level. And after I got my doctorate in clinical psychology, I actually quit psychology and went, and that's when I got my master's in game design. So like you do, you know, like you do. So yeah, it's a little bit all over the place. There's reasons for everything, though nothing makes sense. That kind of like summarizes my life right there.
That's fair enough. You once described yourself as a unicorn. Does that description still fit?
Probably pegacorn, because pegacorns are even more unique.
Oh.
Because they have wings and a horn.
Nice. Oh, Pegasus, unicorn. Yeah, okay. I can see I can see how that would work. Excellent. So you kind of touched on it there, and obviously, you know, it's fair to say I've swooned before when I've had guests on this show. But I'm particularly swooning because my work most overlaps, I think, perhaps with your work on like a one-to-one ratio, with video games and mental health. That's what I'm doing. And, you know, I'm someone who is inspired by your work. I'm just trying to get you to blush so you look half as red as I do. I made the mistake of...
It's not hard.
I made the mistake of going outside today. The red hair... Like, it's not a good look. So, to sort of, like, one of the things I like to unpack here is, like, sort of, well, why do we do these things? You mentioned you walked away from psychology. You what walked you into it in the first place? What took you to community management? Do you mind taking us through that journey?
Sure. So, I mean, back in the beginning, you know, I had my very first video game console when I was, I think, 3 weeks old. So games have always been just an integral part of my, you know, fine motor skills. Don't either just chew on it, you know, and get the, you can get the, what's the osmosis. There we go. You get the osmosis from the Genesis, or that was a Master System actually. So yeah, they've just always been part of my life. They were a way that I played with my siblings. My family is very much into games, car games in particular. My family is a bunch of card sharks and it gets vicious. But playing games has just always been a way that I have connected with my friends and my family. And when I went to college, I originally was studying Russian. I wanted to do Russian language and culture. And about halfway through, I changed my mind because they changed the requirements for the Russian degree and needed me to stay longer. And I wasn't about to do that. So I'd like to say it was some kind of noble pursuit, but it wasn't. It was literally, I took this one class and I liked it and I need to switch my major. And I did. So I switched to psychology. I really enjoyed it. I was one of those people on the floor that if someone had a problem, they went to you. Like, you were just that floor mom. You were just that person who took care of people and helped them solve their problems. That kind of caretaking kind of role is just something I naturally fell into. And then when I graduated with my undergrad, my capstone research was on actually games and aggression. And my very first baby research paper, my very, very first one, never got published, never went anywhere, because the advisor on it was like, I don't like this. And I was just lucky he didn't fail me. Basically said, hey, guess what? It's not the level of violence in a game. It is the frustration tolerance that's responsible for the spike in aggression that we're measuring.
What?
That was 2007.
Hold the phone. You can't come into this podcast and start spitting facts like that. All right. Okay,
I literally
just heard everyone's brain hit the wall. You're blowing their minds. We've spoken on this show before about like the whole video games thing. It doesn't exist. It's fabrication. But like frustration, my go-to line is, I play God of War, an incredibly violent game. Peachy. I play FIFA, I'm ready to throw my controller out the window because that's never a foul, ref, let alone a yellow card. You're having a laugh.
Mm-hmm. Yep, it's frustration and competition are the places that we've seen that when we do measure aggression. And again, in the literature, aggression is like, how much hot sauce did you give someone? And how
angry do you
feel right now?
was that your method, hot sauce?
No, I had biometrics. So I took like pulse and heart rate and then I had
real science. Hold on, what's this?
I know. But I was a baby researcher and I had zero support. So I thought it was a cool finding. Nobody cared. And then I went on to grad school. But I do feel very vindicated because what I found in 2007 has since been replicated in other studies that have been published. And I was like, hey, I was right. Holy crap, I was right. So that always feels good. And for those who graduate with an undergraduate degree in psychology, we all know that you can't do anything with it. So no one tells you that when you go into it.
Well, I mean, that's geography specific, unfortunately. I mean, you know, they'll try and get you doing anything in the UK with a psychology degree, with a teaching assistant. You know, you can theoretically register to be, we've had this discussion before, but you can be a psychologist and just register for that and just be like, yeah, I'm a psychologist now in the UK.
In the US, it's a protected term in the US. So like if someone says there's a psychologist in the US, they have to have a doctorate. And if someone says they're a clinical psychologist, they have to have a doctorate and be licensed. So like it's a highly protected term here.
So like clinical, I think health, I think there's like another one, but like they're like protected titles here. But just general psychologist, even like therapist, I think is a little bit like out of there. So it's a little bit, the landscape's a little bit different over here, but yeah, generally speaking though, because, you know, geopolitical reasons, but everyone has a degree nowadays, so you kind of need a degree plus something else, am I right?
Yeah, absolutely. And so I went to doctor school, And I did the thing where I just brought games into every assignment that I could, because that's what I wanted to study. Again, none of my professors knew, had a clue. They didn't know what was going on. None of them played games. The only research around at that time was about like games and violence. Most of those famous studies that have since been retracted for, statistical tomfoolery, shall we say, around games and violence. And yeah, I just, you want me to write a report about Freud? Okay, I'm going to talk about the id, ego, and superego using Halo characters. And if you want me to write about CBT, I'm going to, talk about how I would do that kind of training with, you mentioned God of War, Kratos. Let's sit down and have a CBT with Kratos.
Oh, well, I mean, Kratos could do some therapy.
I mean, most video game characters could. But I love we all could. We all could.
Well, I mean, everyone could probably do with some therapy at some point. It's just generally beneficial, right?
I agree. I mean, I'm a little biased, but I definitely agree. And but yeah, so like nowadays, I look at all these kids who are in like their psychology and games programs, or they're taking classes that and deal with psychology and games. And I'm like, where was that when I was a little baby psychologist? It didn't exist. So I am genuinely happy now that like that is an actual path that people can pursue, whether it's, the mental health side, whether it's more psychology and you get to like user experience and user interface and user research and all those kinds of ways of folding in psychology. Like it's so much better now than it was. And yeah, then my doctoral dissertation was a longitudinal study on the impact of games and mental health. So I basically, it's only a doctoral dissertation and I had very limited support from faculty because nobody knew what I was doing. And I tracked a couple different variables over a 2-month time span using a very cool tool that was called Raptor. And it was a little plugin that you could use that would report on the amount of time you spent playing a game. So I didn't actually need any self-report in terms of hours played, which is a huge, wrinkle in all of the self-report literature, is because if you're playing a game and you're enjoying the game, you're going to be really terrible about estimating the amount of time you play in a game. Like that's just how they're made. I made that. And then the residency requirement here in the US, like you have to do one, in addition to like part-time practica that you do throughout your training, you're required to do one full year of supervised clinical practice in order to graduate. And that was my internship. And it was, I think it's fair to say it was traumatic. Like I ended up in trauma therapy because I went through that internship. And by the time I was done, I was done. I was done with psychology. I was done with supervisors telling me things that I knew to be wrong. And like sometimes just being straight up unethical. And so 4 months after my 5-year doctoral program, I started a master's in game design, because I thought there had to be more here. The biggest flaw in research that I'd ever seen in psychology was that it was clear that the researchers had never themselves played games, much less made games. And that was just a huge disparity and glaring confounds in all of their studies. So, might as well.
I'm kind of curious. I think perhaps it's me kind of using sort of more contemporary sort of language and sort of sticking it to that situation. But did you think that like what you'd kind of reached was like, almost like a burnout, like you were just like, okay, I'm like all those, you then touched on a few other issues, but like that's quite a lot to go through and like just be like, okay, and then there you go. Especially with, you mentioned like having no support as well.
So one of the things is, in order to get licensed, you need a certain number of supervised hours and things like that. And I was trying for quite a while, even before I graduated, to secure like a postdoc position to get those hours. But I not only nobody wanted to supervise me, because nobody wanted to risk their license on something they didn't understand, which would be games. And again, at the time, games were bad and evil, even more so than now. And then it even got to the point where, because of the issues I had on my internship, like there was a lot of conflict. I got our director in some trouble and she was not very happy with me. And there was a point where I actually had secured like an interview with like a neuropsych place where I could actually integrate some of the gameful stuff I was interested in. And they called me in for an interview. And I know through back channels that my director found out and told them not to hire me and not to interview me. And then they called the next day and canceled it and never said, oh, we need to reschedule. And they never rescheduled. They never called back. And so I ran up against that several times, where either there was fear about supervising someone doing something they didn't understand, which as a license holder, I get that that's scary and I can respect that. But the thing that I couldn't tolerate was literally you have traumatized me for over a year and I have still come through. And now, even though I'm not in your program, you can still like crush me beneath your boot heel. And like, you don't get this kind of red fiery hair by being somebody who lays down. So I applied for a fellowship. It was through a journalism school of all things. I'm like, I know nothing about journalism, but they were doing like games for change. And I got it. And so I started in the Masters of Game Design program 4 months after I graduated with my doctorate. And I just said goodbye to clinical psychology for a long time. Now that said, the same way I brought games into every piece of my psych training, I brought psych into every piece of my games training.
Okay.
So like one of the very first games I made was we had to take an existing game and augment it to be kind of like a games for change type of thing. So I took Jenga and I would write different stressors and different resilience factors on the tiles. And so you would pull the tiles and then the basically whatever effect you drew would have an impact on you, either a resilience or a negative impact. And then of course, you know, the more you play Jenga, the more stressful it becomes because you're literally seeing the holes in your life, so to speak, poked through and like things become less stable over time. And the more stressors you're adding on, like, and it built up. So that was how I was literally modeling like psychological stress and pressure over time through a game mechanic. And one of my most favorite games ever was I literally made like a human body out of felt and cardboard. And I made it a game where like there was one person who could see but couldn't speak. There was one person who could speak but couldn't see. And there was one person who couldn't see but could put things on, or who could see but could put things on a board. And so it was kind of like a game of a nonverbal telephone to get people to put organs in the body where they were supposed to go. It was ridiculous, but it was so much fun to integrate those two things in a playful way where like people learned this is the pancreas.
So sort of like a see no evil, speak no evil, hear no evil operation kind of.
Exactly. That's perfect. Yep. That should have been its tagline.
That sounds genius yet like nightmarish to play. Because I'm now imagining that being like a game on Steam, which it probably is, let's be honest, because have you seen Steam? But like, oh man, yeah. That sounds like, wow. Yeah. That's interesting.
And it was just, yeah. It was such a dramatic change because in psych, every time I brought in games, there was always pushback. Sometimes it was earnest pushback, like tell me more, explain more. I want to understand, which was great. A lot of times it was that's stupid and childish. And no one, I was literally told no one's going to take you seriously if you study games. Like I guess content warning. I was told, quote unquote, it is career suicide. And I hate using that term in that context, but like, that's literally what I was told. When I went into games and I brought in my psychology and my mental health into like into design and into the user research that we used when we were testing our games, it like, I wasn't picked first for the team. Like always the coder and the artist always got picked first. But I was in the middle of the pack, you know, because I could do the user testing and I could figure out what people liked and why they liked it and how we could make the game better based on interviews. Cause that was a skill set that I brought to the table. And it was so refreshing to know that these two things could coexist in a way that like my experience was valued. And it was, I never had that experience in grad school ever. Doctor grad school.
It's really funny that you kind of mentioned that. I mean, obviously this is going to be, you know, I don't need to like feel like you need to date it, but a few years back and like literally just the other month I was chatting to someone who's sort of working in UX who has like a sort of, you know, social science background. And I was sort of being like, oh, you know, like, is this like a career avenue? Because, you know, I'd like to work in industry myself once I've finished with my doctorate. And like, industry is like only just now sort of realizing that there are these highly skilled people that can collect data and analyze data and produce reports with data to a high level of efficacy. Hire me, I'm available. You know what I mean?
You should hire him.
So do you think like it's weird that it's taken this long?
I don't think so, especially because there's so much further to go. I mean, to this day, when if I'm speaking to a game company about, hey, you know, I can do a basically a mental health sensitivity read or a mental health audit of your game. You're like, oh, that's a really interesting idea. We don't have budget or time for that, but what an interesting idea. Like, that's probably going to be on my tombstone of, that's really interesting. We don't have budget or time, but that's really interesting. And part of it is because, you know, the worlds of games and psychology have traditionally been pretty separate, which I always understand from the game side, at least, is because the psychology profession has literally been demonizing game players since like the 1970s. So, and calling, you know, there are like old news clippings that I use in my PowerPoints of like medical and psychological facilities, calling out things like Pac-Man as being addictive, or, you know, Space Invaders as making people violent. And like, okay, no, of course you don't want to work with us, because if we're literally telling you, hey, you made a game, you made a murder simulator, that's not going to be someone you want to work with. And so I don't blame them at all.
So let me put it to you this way. Did you prefer playing for Team Red or Team Blue?
Which team is which? I like, my favorite color is purple. So I think that's the best answer I can give to that question.
Good choice. I feel like
a mix of red and blue.
Yeah, I like that. Okay. I asked that half playfully, just because I kind of really get that from the perspective of the game side of things. And you know, obviously, you know, psychology, it is what it is. But I've kind of always viewed it through the lens of like, you can analyze anything through psychology, though. Like, you can do a psycho sort of breakdown of a novel or a film, or sort of break down the trope. I mean, I did a freaking Let's Psychology as opposed to a Let's Play of like a horror game. It was like, let's break down some of the mechanics, let's break down this theme setting, the story through that lens. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of, you know, the fact that that's kind of always been my kind of perspective. It's kind of weird that that's been sort of held at arm's length, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, there's, if you want to take it out of games, like there is a history of like basically using the DSM as the monster manual, or I guess over there, the ICD-11 or the International Classification of Disorders, whatever version of like, hey, we want to make a scary monster killer. Let's just look into, you know, this book of disorders and figure out what that looks like. I mean, that's something that's been rampant in games for a very long time, but also just in other media and books, film, television. The tropes that we see around mental illness are just really common, and they have been since almost the medium was invented. One of the very earliest films ever, like Black and White, No Sound, featured a villain who was crazy and had like a severe mental illness, and that's why he was crazy and violent. So it's tropes we see time and time again. So it is getting better, and we are seeing the crossplay between the two fields a little bit more. And if I had to guess, it is because games themselves, I mean, and they haven't been for a while, but psychology is a slow moving profession. We're never the cutting edge of anything. We like to kind of wait in the back and watch everybody else go first.
Psychoanalyzing anyone, am I right?
Yeah, you're just sitting back and going, but like, it's inescapable with the amount of people who play games. You know, there's over 2 billion people on the planet. Here in the US, over 2/3 of Americans play games. And so the pitch I always give clinicians when I'm trying to tell them why this is important to understand is like a cultural perspective, is that the chance that someone coming into your office plays games is really high. And if you work with children or adolescents, it is almost guaranteed. And so to pretend that this thing that is a cultural phenomenon, and, you know, for a lot of people, a sense of culture and identity for themselves, to pretend that that doesn't exist or that it's inherently bad, we wouldn't do that with anything else. If someone loved Harry Potter, we would address that. If someone loved sports, we would integrate that into our therapy. We wouldn't see it as a bad thing, even though like, you're much more likely to get a concussion playing American football than you are playing Call of Duty. So just kind of normalizing that this is prominent in everyday life. And if you want to ignore it, that's fine. But then don't work with people who are in these populations. But that's pretty much everybody. So yeah, I think that's why we've gotten to where we are, is they're everywhere. You can't pretend that they're not a cultural force anymore.
Okay. I apologize. Like, I asked quite a lot from you there. So I apologize. That's quite a lot, like, to just straight off the bat.
Did you see how I crushed that question, though? Like, come on, give me some hard ones.
Oh, I mean, it's a casual interview. It's not a test. Like,
okay. That competitive bit coming out. Let me pull that back.
I mean, I suppose you can compete with other people that have been on the show, but I've also heard you don't listen to podcasts you haven't been on. So that's maybe a retrospective thing you can do. I don't know. Let's see.
Yep.
That's a huge
problem.
I know
Rachel's been on, so I can now go back and listen to her. So I'm very excited about that.
Okay. So Masters in game design, and you were sort of like middle of the pack pick of the team. Okay. That your words, not...
That's what you took from all that.
I was just trying to then say, what happened next? Take us through the next bit of that journey.
So I graduated and I was able to land a job at a nonprofit that was supposed to be focusing on social emotional learning and the intersection of games. And so I worked there for a while. It ended in a way that I was not particularly happy with. Basically, a psychology and games company decided they didn't need a psychologist or a game designer. So,
okay, sorry, just glasses coming off for that one.
Yeah. But actually, you know, it's good because that means I was actually able to give hours to take this. And so I started to take this part time. That was December of 2019. And, you know, so I guess stepping back a little bit from that, while I was at that nonprofit, I got my license. So, you know, I graduated in 2014 with my doctorate, but I didn't sit for my licensure exam until I think it was August 2019. So big old gap in there when I was doing mostly, you know, all game stuff. And then I passed. So yay. And then I started to take this in December of that year. And then January 2020, I got the jurisprudence, or like the law exam required to practice in the state of Maryland. I had to sit for that, and I took that and I passed. And then I started with a private practice. So seeing clients is like, so my full-time job is now therapist. I have come full circle. I have done a couple years of games, nonprofit work, you know, I'm doing take this on the side, just like 5 hours a week, but I am a full-time psychologist. I am so grown up. And 3 weeks later, the entire world shut down because of COVID. So I picked a hell of a time to become a therapist. And yeah, my entire clinical career has been telehealth, except for like 3 weeks.
Cometh the hour, cometh the legendary therapist, I guess.
Something like that. But yeah, so that's, and then what happened is that last year I went on maternity leave to bring in my second little cherub, little dude. And so I wound down the private practice I was at. And then after maternity leave, I switched to working to take this full time. And now I'm seeing clients one day a week. So pretty much there was a switcheroo there. And so now I'm full time with take this as the head of community, where I get to do a lot of really fun stuff, from speaking and presenting on their behalf, to going to conventions and being there, to working on curriculum development and running our Discord, and, you know, providing our streaming ambassadors with, you know, advice and support for when they come up against difficult things in their streams, like trauma dumping and setting boundaries. And so I get to do a lot of things that I thoroughly enjoy. I get to do it, like, just earlier this morning, part of my job, quote unquote, is I designed an emote for Twitch that's a goose carrying a knife that says crimes. So, you know, I got to, I get to have my design itch scratched. You know, I get to do my academic stuff with the curriculum development. I get to do streaming. I get to play games. So it really is all these aspects. And then I have my private practice on the side to kind of continue to work and hone that skill set and to be as available as I can to help as many people as I can without burning myself out, which I definitely was by the time my maternity leave came around last year.
First question is, can you animate the goose to swing the knife? Because I think that would be something that would greatly enhance it. At least
so I don't know how to animate. That is a skill I don't have. Like, I can do graphic design, and I can do Photoshop and Illustrator, and I know After Effects, and I can edit video. I can also do diagnostic intakes, and I can give a Rorschach. I can also run communities and sports leagues, but I have not gotten around to animating. So the answer is yes, just I don't know how to yet.
I'm going to say almost good, because like, there needs to be something else for the rest of us to be able to do. Like, give us a chance, you know, like,
okay. I'll leave that out there. If someone wants to animate my knife wielding crimes goose, I'm happy to share the files.
So take this then. I think I'm going to try and get the blushometer up a dozen notch here. Being obviously I started my PhD, 2021, was it 2020? Yeah, it was. I really had to think about that for a second. So I was really taking that deep dive into reading the literature, because you know, you think you know a little bit and then you don't. It was not long before your name had come up, in the literature. Obviously, I'd heard your episode on the Psychology of Games podcast as well. And, you know, I was like, oh, okay, this is the business. I remember particularly your conference talk. I can't visualize where it was from, but I remember the PDF talking about mental health representation in villains, you know, in games. I remember that standing out. I remember like a few different journal articles as well. Again, like, I can't remember where they were from, but I read a lot of PDFs with your name on it and was like, oh, wow, this is like, this is exactly where I'm aiming. So, and then because, you know, I'm also incredibly wild and think, well, you know what, grad school doesn't pay well enough. Let's do content creation. We kind of first met through the Take This kind of circuit. You know what, honestly, like thinking back now, I can't remember at what point, like I joined the Discord or anything. But I just remember it happening and then being incredibly welcomed, which is a byproduct of the community. Everyone should join up. It's a great thing.
The first time we met was the interview for the ambassadorship, because you and I had to meet over Zoom and I got to not interview you. We just talked. It was a friendly chat where you were very nervous and I felt so bad.
I wasn't like one of the first people to be interviewed for that as well? Interviewed. So yeah, I was absolutely... I was very nervous.
Believe you told me, sorry, I'm nervous, I talk a lot. That's okay.
Which I also do when I'm not nervous, so it doesn't really help.
Spoilers, he made the cut.
Here we are, it worked out, you know what I mean? But that was very nerve-wracking for a multitude of reasons. Because obviously I'd read your work, but also I was like, oh, there's like something is riding on this, if that makes sense. Because, you know, I'm a minnow in the streaming space, but I like to think I do good work, you know?
You do. You do good work.
Yeah, so that was the first time we'd sort of, like, spoken, suppose it's great to say, and, like, yeah, obviously I've been fanboying ever since. but how have you kind of found, like, you know, working for Take This and sort of community management, because there might be someone listening going, that feels a couple of steps removed.
Again, like the community management, I mean, one, having a psych degree is hugely helpful if you want to do community management, because you are literally dealing with people and their feelings all the time. But really what that comes out of is that 10 years of community management I had through Halo and through Griffball. And like, I learned everything in that experience. There was no handbook. There was no Streamlabs giving me tips on how to run a community. There was barely Twitch at that point. And when there was Twitch, there was only one button and that was ban. That's how old I am. There were none of these other fun little dongles that you can have or emotes or anything like that. Like, it was, you can be here or you can be banned.
Simple
and so
days,
you know, those
times.
Are the CM streets that I came up on, and I navigated some really hard things and I made some really dumb mistakes, and you know, but you come out of it the other side of like, wow, you know, I did that and I know what it takes. And so if there are any community managers out there or community directors, like, it is often thought of like an entry-level position, or like we can have the intern do it, or it's a part-time. No, it is one of the hardest skills out there, because like, you can teach hard skills like coding, you can teach management skills. Community management requires like this empathic, intuitive understanding, like these soft skills around knowing how to interact with people with a variety of different issues and a variety of different presentations, and finding the balance between protecting the community but also supporting somebody in need but also representing the org. And so you're really in like the middle of this sandwich, and so navigating that can be incredibly challenging. And then that's on a good day, and if someone's mad at you, guess what, or the company you work for, you're the one who hears about it. You are the one who takes the brunt of that kind of verbal assault sometimes. And yeah, it really helps having the psych degree, I'm not gonna lie.
I mean, there is no handbook,
mostly having to learn on the fly.
There is no handbook for, you know, strange scouse albino people hitting you up being, I love your wear, do you want to be on my podcast? There's no training for that. You can't, there's no way to prepare for that type of thing.
You can't anticipate. You just gotta respond in the moment, you know. You just gotta feel it, like the force, let it flow through you.
And obviously then you tie all that together with sort of Take This, which is, you know, mental health and video games and the video game industry as a whole as well. So you kind of have, I don't know, my words, not anyone else's, everything that they possibly could have wanted. And some, you know, maybe.
Wow. I don't think I've ever thought about it that way. But I do remember, you know, Kelly, like 4 or 5 years ago thinking, you know, if I could find a balance between doing games and teaching and psych, like that's my holy trinity. And I have those three, but they are not in balance. My Triforce pieces are there, but they are not symmetrical or in balance. And I think that's something that I am continuing to try and work on. For example, I think one of the questions that will come later, so I'm just going to cheat and say it now, like if I had more time to do anything, is like, I wish I had time to dev. Like I've got a game that I did for my master's thesis in game design, and I've wanted to remake it for 5 years, but game dev is so hard. It's so hard and it's so time consuming, and I can't code to save my life. So it's mostly looking at like visual scripting, but then I'm limited by what visual scripting can let me do. And I don't have the mad coding skills to like write an inventory system or something like that. And I've tried, my brain just does not, you know, my coding classes I got through because my professors were very kind and they rewarded effort. Let's be honest. I got an A for effort in those classes. In my 3D modeling class, like you don't even want to know. Like I think that's the only class that ever made me cry. None of my psych classes, but my 3D modeling class, like trying to sculpt. Oh my God, it was awful. But they took pity on me and they, you know, they rewarded the effort, which I appreciate. So yeah, finding some kind of balance in that world would be nice. So I think I've accepted right now that I can have two of the three at once. And what those two are can shift from time to time. But there was a period when I was doing all three. So I was Take This, full, like not quite full-time, but pretty close. I was seeing clients almost full-time and I was teaching, and it was too much.
You can't do two things nearly full. That's not right. That doesn't, no.
No, there's a wonderful quote from Parks and Rec by Rick Offerman. He says, you know, never half-ass two things, whole-ass one thing. Yeah. So I just think about, okay, I'm whole-assing two things. That's what I'm doing.
Interesting sentence for the captions. But I'll leave that where it is. Two things I kind of want to just like, you know, highlight from that is, how do you feel knowing that you've kind of inspired like a route? Because I have had this conversation with people offline, I've said it on this podcast, like, yeah, you know, I kind of thought about the Kelly Dunlap route of also trying to get something in game design to complement my psychological knowledge, because that would be the dream, would it not? You know, how does that make you feel? Yeah, I can pretend to be a therapist too, like I'm playing one on TV.
Let me lay back a little bit. It's very much like when someone says they read something that I wrote. It doesn't connect. There's just a disconnect in my brain because it's so weird. Like why would, and I just see me as me and all the flaws that come with me. And so, you know, whether I, you know, forgot to wash my hair this morning, or, you know, the fact the baby spit up all over my shirt, or, you know, I'm late on a car payment. Like I see me as the totality of me. And like, it's not bad, but I don't ever think of it as being like aspirational, you know, because there are people that I look up to and I'm like, oh my God, that is what success looks like. And I just got to keep working towards that. But I do try to remind myself of like, okay, if I told myself 5 years ago what I'm doing right now, I would be blown away. So I do try to keep that balance. And so when there are people who want to go that same path, it actually makes me excited. One, because hopefully the path is easier than the one that I had to, you know, hack my way through with machete. And also because I think it just makes the space better. When I go to psych conferences, I'm the only person there with any game training. And when I go to games conferences, less so now, but I'm usually the only person there with any psych training. But now, like that, again, that is shifting. There's a lot more psychology being represented, but it's usually like research-based as opposed to like clinical and like feels and stuff. So it's good to have more people in that space, because the two, I mean, you can't separate your psychology from your gameplay. You know, like understanding player motivations is understanding human motivation, and understanding human motivation is understanding player motivation. These things are not separate. We just have two fields who are looking at it from different angles. You know, one from like a health perspective and one from a, you know, marketing engagement perspective. And so the more we're able to bridge that gap, I think it's, you know, good things are going to come from that. Because nothing good comes from being siloed. And the most fascinating people that I know that I look up to are the ones who have this really odd mismatch of two different things. And they bring those merged perspectives together and they create a very unique way of looking at the world that to me is so much more interesting than a person who is an expert, but just in one really, really deep silo. It's exciting because if I want to get vulnerable here, I've had many conversations with my own therapist and with my husband, imposter syndrome based, but oftentimes it comes down to it's really lonely. It's really lonely when you're out there.
It's lonely at the top, isn't it?
Not at the top, but at the edge, you know, at when you're doing something that nobody else is doing, it can be really lonely. And, you know, when I'm trying to tell my therapist about my feeling, but I have to take 20 minutes to explain what Twitch is, or, you know, when I'm trying to talk to my lovely supportive husband, but he doesn't understand game terminology or psychology terminology. Like, he's there and supportive, but it's really hard when you have to kind of change how you're talking about something. You can't just be purely, authentically, genuinely geeky and nerding out about the thing you want, because there's not really anybody else out there that can do that with you. And now that I have a better community, so you and Rachel Coward and Sarah Hayes and Dr. B and people like Anxiety and like this whole host of community that we've built from people who share this interest, even if it's not exactly the same, it feels a lot less lonely. So I'm glad that you're part of the crew, because
I think it's a really, like, I'm trying to not sound too like wishy-washy, but it feels like a special moment to be in that, like, you know, the meeting sort of the game studies sort of crew and sort of everyone who is involved at the moment. It feels really exciting. I'm really, really, really lucky as well in that, like, the next cohort after mine, someone else is also studying games. So we're like high-fiving and like talking about all the research we're going to do after we're qualified. Like, yous are not ready for, we're going to take the world by storm. It's going to be amazing. Beth, shout out. but yeah, as well as, I think, you know, I'm only able to do what I'm doing because people like yourself laser sorted through that forest in the first place. So I think, like, where I'm at is owed to people like yourself, like Rachel, like Dr. Linda Kay as well, like over here, you know, who, you know, I got numerous rejections because no university wanted to, like, fund game research. They were just like, nah, you know what I mean? The other thing there, I think, is worth saying is that when you mentioned perspective, it's really important as well. And I've always kind of said I'd like to do some sort of therapeutic thing as well, but again, the UK is very different. PsyDs are virtually like gold nuggets. You struggle to find one. 9 times out of 10, you already have to be working in some type of psychotherapeutic practice to do one, to get the accreditation. So, like, I kind of always known that I was going to need a undergrad, master's, and doctorate, then like a year of clinical training or psychotherapeutic training, you know, alongside, you know, what would hopefully be game design. So the route, even just geographically, is a little bit different to get to the Dunlap status, if you will. But it's achievable. It's achievable.
I mean, the number one advice I always give is just, other people typically have better advice. The mine is just very purely, you know, from my experience of, you just have to be more stubborn than anybody else. You know, if you get told no 10 times, then you go find an 11th. If someone tells you your career is, quote, you know, career suicide because you're pursuing something that matters to you, then you have to ignore them. And again, it's hard and it's scary. And I have tons of privilege of, you know, through all of this, I got married pretty young. Like, I was got married in between undergrad and grad. So, like, we got married pretty young. So I was incredibly lucky to have someone who had benefits and I didn't have to worry about healthcare. I didn't have to worry about having a job while doing my doctorate. I didn't have to worry about having a job while I was in my master's program pursuing games and mental health. I would like to think that, you know, I would want people to have that same opportunity, but I also want to be like super transparent and open about, I had some significant privilege in my ability to go those routes. And a lot of that was financial. So, you know, I just want to be honest about that.
I think that's important. I think I've said it before just myself. I think it's really easy to look at like the things that I'm doing. If I give you like my ticks box list of things that I have done that sound hella impressive, you go, oof, okay, Chris, fair play, you just bragging here. And I'll go, that is built on a foundation of rejection, tears, and spite, and caffeine, okay, obviously, to get me to this point, you know? Like, to really, mm-hmm. like, every time I got to those rejections, like, yeah, I was sad about it. I genuinely got upset. I thought, like, it's never going to happen. But it was always, and I joke to this day, the application I put in for this PhD was, this is my last go, because I can't keep going through this emotional turmoil. And then for some reason they picked it. And I was like, let's freaking go. And yeah. Here we are.
I like how you phrase that, of the success is built on like this massive foundation of rejection and failure. I mean, to this day, like I'll submit something for publication and I still am rejected 9 times out of 10, but that just fuels my hate fires. And, you know, again, it keeps the hair red. So I'm like, well, fine, screw you. I'm going to go find somewhere else, or I'm going to go do something different, or, you know, like, I'll show you. Spite is powerful. And I just, you know, I want to shout out to Spite for pulling me through a lot.
So we've kind of talked a lot, we've got the journey, which is really important and really impactful. And you're sort of CMing and sort of therapizing at the moment, but sort of what else, if anything, are you up to? Sort of what's next? Have you got any research in the pipeline? Anything exciting?
So I do have some research in the pipeline.
Yes. More citations.
I have a paper that's technically coming out next year, even though I did it and submitted it in 2020. So it's been a very long and arduous process, but it's been about the mental health of streamers during COVID. And I'm super excited to see that come out.
A PAX panel on that, a PAX 2021? Yep. Yes.
PAX Online 2020. Yeah, PAX Online 2021, because we didn't have the data before then. And I did that with Anxiety and one of my grad students. And, you know, that to me was really, really fascinating, because this was an area that I don't feel anybody else had touched. I literally could not find any research existing that looked specifically at the mental health of streamers themselves. Like, there was stuff on like the psychology of viewers. There was maybe an article or two about like the difficulty of being a person with a mental illness streaming, or a person with a disability streaming, but there was nothing on like, let's ask streamers about their mental health.
The like, only kind what of is like, that like for them? Twitch research that I had sort of seen in the periphery was more audience focused. That I remember, like, I read or at least heard of an article that was, why do people donate? But that's like the most mm-hmm. that you could find.
Yeah, I mean, that's because it comes from marketing. Like, marketing and people wanting to know why users are coming and why they're giving money, like, there's a lot of research dollars behind that. But like, how is your streamer feeling? Which I still argue is pretty important, even monetarily, because if you don't have the streamer, you don't have the viewers. But regardless, so that's in the bag, and I'm super excited about that. And I'm moving on to another study. I'm super curious around how streamers use the mental health tags and how versus how viewers use the mental health tags. And so I've got this little experiment that I set up with Dr. Sarah Hayes and also with Anxiety again. And basically we're going to do an observational study and then some mixed method study. And we're going to look at, you know, if we take a snapshot of everybody who's using the mental health tag right now on Twitch, what are they playing? Are they just chatting? Are they playing a game? Why are they using the mental health tag? Are they actually talking about mental health issues, or is there mental health content in the game? Like, why are they using it? And then having surveys asking viewers, like, if you search for the mental health tag, why are you doing that? Because my suspicion is there's a differentiation, regardless of what Twitch says, because Twitch does have descriptors on these. Mm-hmm. My guess is a lot of times streamers will use these tags as identity markers. So either mental health, or, I mean, considering they put the entire DSM as a tag, which I still think is a terrible idea, but what do I know? Whereas viewers are looking, they may be looking for that community, but they're learning, looking more to talk and vent about that particular topic. And so there's a disconnect between this is who I am and the viewer wanting to come in and like oftentimes trauma dump about that topic. So we'll see what comes out of that. And I'm hoping for some recommendations for streamers who, you know what, maybe some recommendations on how to use the mental health tags to get the kind of audience and interaction that they want.
It's funny you mention that because obviously my mind immediately exploded to what I use. And I think I just do use the general mental health one because it's an overarching theme of the channel. Like we talk about things in a very safe and nuanced way and, you know, like always linking to resources. There's a timer that goes off that takes people to the Take This resource page. There's a command for it specifically if, like, you know, something potentially triggering is on screen. So we just pop that into chat should people need it. But it's just kind of like it is overarching because I might be talking about something specifically. I think perhaps I would feel more comfortable if there was like a psychology tag. Like if like, oh, I'm just talking about psychology more generally as a subject. And then unless I'm like having like a mental health related discussion, include that. That's my opinion. But what do I know? I don't run Twitch. I just use it. You know,
I feel that.
that's some interesting stuff. Obviously, like I can't, I'm so excited. It's already in my reference list. Let's just say this. I am
not
hyped.
I mean, yeah, it's one of those things that I think that's one of the glorious things about not being a PhD. You know, I'm a PsyD and I've done a bunch of research, but obviously PsyDs, our focus is not on research. So I don't have pressure to publish or perish. I don't have pressure to like, if my CV doesn't include 20 different citations, I'm bad because I have that PsyD that says, oh no, most of my work is going to be clinically based with individual clients, which really frees me up to just pursue what I'm interested in. It doesn't need to have funding research behind it. It's just, I'm curious about this and I want to find out about it. And that to me is the best kind of research.
No, I feel that. I think a big thing I'm passionate about is, you know, we sort of discussed it before we got on, but I'm very much against this ivory tower kind of perspective. Like if you have nearly half the population playing games, but only 10% of them can read the academic papers about it, what's the point? There's a disconnect there. So I'm very much kind of, I'm using the powers I have to produce like good science on video games, like pre-registered. So like I'm telling everyone what I'm going to do before I do it. I'm going to release my data out to let other people chew on it to make sure I'm not doing any tomfoolery, as you put it. To be like, I'm doing this in a transparent way. And I've said to my supervisors, like, while obviously, you know, I have hypotheses, I hope I'm going to find things, or I assume I'm going to find things. I'm less concerned about that than I am about just doing it correctly. And doing it like in an ethical way, I guess, and like an honest way, and then sort of researching what I want to research. I think that's like the motivation for me in that regard.
I mean that ethical piece. I mean, you talk about bridging between psychology and game design. Like that's one of the places where I am the loudest. Is, you know, when you're playing a game, you can open someone up. You can open up their history. You can open up their emotional processes within minutes. Like there are games where you're crying within the first 5 minutes of the game because it's so emotionally powerful or evocative.
Or if you're me, you're not. Everyone, the first 5 minutes of The Last of Us is so upsetting. I played it. I was like, what's this? I don't care, mate. It's been 5 minutes. I'm not emotionally invested.
It's okay. but you know, something like What Remains of Edith Finch or That Dragon Cancer, you know, these games that just are emotional powerhouses, and this idea that like, hey, if you can crack into something that I studied to 23rd grade, I went to 23rd grade to learn how to open people up.
What's that in really tender British, parts. Please? Do you know, like
23rd grade. Well, that's 5 years of elementary, 3 years of middle, 4 years of high school, 4 years of undergraduate, 5 years of doctoral, and 2 years of an additional master's.
Numbers, yes.
Numbers, yeah. Yep. A lot of time, a lot of study, a lot of student debt. But basically, like, if I have studied for this long to be able to open someone up and explore these feelings with them and how to close them back up and have it be a positive experience, and you can literally walk in, like, play a game and rip somebody to shreds. Like maybe we need to take care with that. Maybe this idea that, oh God, back in the days, back in the early Games for Change days, you know, there was this huge focus on empathy. And like, if we can get our players to feel,
VR is the magical empathy machine. Yeah.
if we can just get people to feel the experience. And it's like, first of all, empathy doesn't require action. It's a completely internalized experience that does not require any action on part of the person. What you're talking about is compassion, which is a different thing. But also this idea that just because you make someone feel something doesn't mean that that is the way you want them to feel. Like someone getting overwhelmed and shutting down because they can't play your game because it's too triggering. Congratulations, you made them feel something, but you've made them feel so much that they will not finish your game. They will walk away. And as a game dev, like, that's a problem.
So I said this on one of the previous episodes with Dr. Jamie Madigan, and, you know, the whole thing with like Elden Ring, and people saying, I like the fact it gets me so frustrated, I'm in tears. And I'm like, okay, maybe we should put the controller down and go through our emotional regulation to make sure that because games are primarily meant to be fun. I'm not against challenge, but like, if it's affecting you that much, then we maybe need to take a couple deep breaths and make sure that we're doing okay. Because that's not, you don't want to get into any type of frenzy. Like, again, it's great to feel things. Like, I've put games down and gone for 20 minutes. And like, I've cried at games and felt so many emotions, but like, it's never felt like beyond my realm of control. And if it gets to that point, that's really like, okay, let's slow it down a bit, boss. I do believe, correct me if I'm wrong, that you actually delivered a talk to this effect at Games for Change last year.
Yep, I did one for Games for Change, and I did one at a Game Developers Conference.
Nice. And what was
talked about it, and it's in the... Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, what was the response to that? How did you find doing those?
So there's usually two responses. One is like, this is super helpful. Thank you so much. You know, this is a lot for us to chew on. I focused very strongly on the design side of my training as well, of like, here are things you can actually design. This is not theoretical. These are applied things that you can do to make your games safer. Like, think about the psychological safety of your players, and here's ways you can do that. And then, so typically that's the response of, this is fascinating, great, you know, pat on my back. The other one tends to be from auteurs, or people who think themselves the artiste and want to tell me that, you know what, I am disrupting the creative intent. And like, there's no content warning on the Mona Lisa or something like that. And I'm like, that's a painting. This is a game. These are different things. I actually had somebody push back really hard because I made the bold statement that I don't think that Insane Asylum should be used in horror games anymore. It's tired, it's boring, and if you're using it, it's probably for lazy reasons. Stop it. Think about what, like, is it a shortcut for Be Afraid? Then stop using that trope. It's awful. Like, just, you don't need to do that.
Listen, Kelly, don't come over here and take...
You're infringing on my artistic vision.
Don't come over here and take away our low-hanging fruit. That requires effort.
Yeah. Yeah, and so he's like, if I want to design, I'm like, okay, you know, I can't tell you what to design, but I can tell you that that's not going to, like, you're just perpetuating a really tired, lazy stereotype that is objectively harmful. Like, going inpatient is already terrifying. Like, we don't need to villainize or demonize it any further. It's already a terrifying experience, even in the best of circumstances. So why is it that you are so preciously attached to your insane asylum? Like, do you have nothing else in you? And so that's usually the pushback I get, is either I'm disrupting with their vision, or the other common in the same vein is that if you put in a content warning, it loses its impact. So I usually talk about Life is Strange and the suicide scene in Life is Strange, and how there's no content warning at all. And there's absolutely no way to navigate that part of the game. Like, if you refuse to engage, you can't finish the game. There's no shortcut. There's no load next scene. There's no skip. You have to go through this incredibly triggering, emotionally upsetting experience.
So it's funny you picked that out, like, as an example, because I knew, you know, Kate Marsh was having a bad time, and I tried to do what the game would allow me to do to help her. And I was genuinely, and I don't use the word like, I was devastated when I pressed the wrong button. And you know, events unfolded. So, and the clip doesn't exist anymore, but I remember just sitting there going like, oh, now I'm really sad and I feel responsible for this. And like, you know, I replayed it and I was like, okay, because let's see what happens if we don't mess up. But when I then was able to untangle that and be like, the game made me feel like I was responsible, like I had made a mistake for something that's a fictional, and be completely beyond the realms of my control. And I get that's maybe like the point they were trying to make, that you can't hold yourself responsible for someone's mental health and potential things like suicide. Okay, fair. But you could have told me before we did it. Also, when you're in a game that has rewindy time, magical space shenanigans, but we're just not going to let you use it for this bit, kind of, you know, you're bullcrapping me a little bit there. Come on, come on.
That is definitely the stump that I get on. I was like, this was a design decision, and it was entirely for the experience of the designer. The experience of the player was not considered.
And do you want to know how that's truly known, though? Is that it doesn't actually matter which end you go, because it's basically just a minor plot of the rest of the game. It means nothing. And it makes it completely meaningless.
Yeah. And I mean, like you said, there's timey-wimey stuff in there. And the fact that you couldn't go back. I mean, imagine if you were somebody who had a loss due to suicide, and you'd had those feelings of responsibility. Because oftentimes when we lose people to suicide, we do. Even if we're not on the rooftop with them, like, we feel like I should have seen this coming, or I should have done more. I should have noticed. I should have said something different. Like, imagine just popping that up in a game that someone's playing for enjoyment. And
not susceptible, but a very impressionable audience that are likely to be experiencing things like that. You know, it was aimed
vulnerable.
At teenagers, you know, it had a female protagonist, which was sort of rare for its time as well. Like, you know, and then, I mean, that's also not my only personal issue with Life is Strange. They pull a similar rug with disability, and that's a different hill.
That bothers me a lot too. Like, ooh, that's a pretty morally gross thing you're implying through here, through your design, but okay.
Which is why I always say I respect the game. I have some issues with it though.
And that's always the, you know, it's hard to give talks at games conferences if you talk poorly of a game, because then people don't invite you back.
Yeah.
So I always frame it as like, it did a lot of good things, but here are some places that it could do better. And I hope games in the future also do better. Because this idea of, if there's a content warning, then it's not going to be as impactful. And, you know, I literally have a slide that says trauma is not a plot twist. And so if the weight of your game rests on triggering something that's incredibly potentially problematic and as common as suicide, then you are doing it wrong. You are not designing well. You are leaning on tropes, and you are leaning on like massive buttons that people have, vulnerabilities that people have, to create a feeling. And that's not ethical. It's not.
And I think
that's my rant on that.
Well, the thing for me, I kind of, you know, again, it's the lens of what I know now, obviously, but It's not like you can't talk about those things, but about doing it with a level of nuance. And I mentioned the Silent Hill 2 playthrough before, but for a game that came out in early 2000, it actually handles things with a really good level of nuance. And there is some triggering content in there, but it's never like a shock value kind of thing. It's maybe a little bit more subtle. And like, you actually sit back and go, whoa, this insinuates something really deep, and, you know, it gives you something to think about. So it's not like it's impossible. It's not like you can't do it. You know, it's not like there is no other choice.
I mean, the juxtaposition I always really enjoy is that Life is Strange is not a psychologically safe game. Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2 is. Because in Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2, they had the no Russian scene, which is, you know, it happened pretty soon after 9/11 here in the US. And it's a scene where you go into a airport and you shoot civilians. But one, the game warns you about it and you can opt out. Two, you can skip the level and face no penalty. Like, if you skip it, you can still 100% the game. There's no achievements or anything for going through that level. So you can 100% skip it without any penalty, which is crucial. And
correct me if I'm wrong, that's something they did add afterwards. That was after people had been like, whoa, boss, you might want to change this. Because I'm sure I remember a time where you couldn't do that.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. But at least they did it. Like, they did it, which, again, Life is Strange has been out for how long? And there's still no content warning on it in any. And we played through Life is Strange True Colors. There's no content warnings on that either, even though there are some pretty serious themes that go on in that too. So, but yeah, it's this idea of like, are you giving players informed consent when they're going into something that could be emotionally and psychologically upsetting? And then are you also giving them the ability to opt out? And if this sounds like research, it is. Like, the informed consent around research participants is directly what I pull from. people should be able to leave without consequence. So you shouldn't have to miss out on an achievement just because you don't want to go through something emotionally traumatizing. People should be able to quit at any time and be able to finish the game because they've already bought it. So I don't, you know, if you quit Life is Strange after that scene, you're only in the first, possibly the first part of the second chapter. Mm-hmm. You've bought a game and you're not going to be able to play it. Like that's a negative, that's coercion right there. You're pushing people to go through an experience they don't want to go to. And I always try to remind devs that like, you want players to be happy they went through the challenge. You don't want someone to come out the other side of your game resentful and angry and wondering, why did you as a designer make that choice? Why did you make me do that? Because then you've lost them. If they play the game, they may never finish it. They probably will never come back to it. And they will probably never come back to anything else you make either because of how vulnerable and crappy you made them feel.
Now I'm gonna say my bias is sort of, you know, up front, and I agree with you entirely. I think that's the way it should be done. But I think to pose a question as a game dev, with your game dev hat on, do you think like just an upfront, like starting the game warning is sufficient, like just like a broad stroking thing, or do you think it needs to be more granular? Because say again, for example, it's a game I love, but I talk about it a lot, like Final Fantasy VII has a whole load of things going on in there. But I genuinely think that like if you just said upfront, by the way, you know, like you sort of get with films, this will contain scenes of this, and this, just so you know. And again, there's nothing shock value-y, really, in my opinion. There's nothing sort of like really where like it hits you over the head with it. That's kind of my sort of thing. It's like it's there, and you can, and even, again, that's probably a bad example because the characters within the game actually deal with things themselves, and that's part of the journey. What's your opinion on that? Like, is just a bog standard press A to continue thing sufficient?
I mean, I think you need to have a content warning at the beginning that is both broad but also specific. You know, if someone's saying like, oh, there are psychological themes. Yeah, well, that didn't tell me anything. And if you say, well, there's, you know, violence. Okay, well, are we talking about war violence? Are we talking about sexual violence? Like, we need to be more specific. You don't need to tell me the plot point, but you do need to be very honest. Like, Hellblade was not ruined because in the trigger warning screen, it said this deals with psychosis. Nobody was like, oh no, the game is ruined forever. Like, come on. So I think that, and that's such low hanging fruit. That is literally text on a screen before your game starts. Like, it is not a big deal. I think that's the least that we could expect. And then what I like to see, though, are built-in mechanics when you're dealing with those situations. So, if, for example, going back to Life is Strange, I would not have such an issue with that if you could skip it. You know, the way that you can skip, you know, no Russian in Call of Duty, Modern Warfare 2. Like, if you're not going to force someone to go through that experience in order to continue playing the game. The other example I usually use is What Remains of Edith Finch, because there's a scene where a child dies. Like a two-year-old in a bathtub. And at the time I was playing, I had a two-year-old and he loved the bathtub. And it just hit really, really too close to home and I couldn't play. And so I'd have someone else play through that part. And otherwise I wouldn't have gotten to finish the game. And it's a brilliant, beautiful game. And I'm so grateful I played it. I just wish I didn't have to go through that part because it was too much. So I want to see things like that. If you know that there are these difficult parts coming, you know, child death, like death is one thing. Child death is something else. Death of an infant is something else. You know, like violence and war trauma is something, but like specific, you know, war related traumas is something else. Again, violence happens in games, but like sexual violence is something very specific. And people should be warned about that ahead of time. And the ability that if it is, I think it was a Tomb Raider, there was this there was a cut scene where Lara was kind of found out by one of the baddies. And there was like this insinuation that he was going to assault her. But it was a cut scene and it lasts like 3 seconds and you mash X and she like kicks him in the nuts and runs away. So like that is uncomfortable, but still it's so brief as opposed to something like Life is Strange, which is if you make the wrong decision, somebody is going to die and it's going to be 100% your fault. And it is categorically different than something like The Walking Dead, because your decisions there also can end up with people dying, but not that directly, not that one-to-one ratio with like real life experiences. At least Walking Dead, you're dealing with zombies. Mm-hmm. You know, there is some abstraction. There is some space for breathing and safety that doesn't exist in Life is Strange.
Yeah, no, I think, I'm in agreement. And I think that's like, you know, Is it asking for too much? I don't think so. I don't think it
no,
is.
No, it's not.
Especially
and this
when...
is why people get mad at me. And the auteurs are like, oh, you are ruining my game. And I'm like, I do not care. And apparently I am French.
I mean, so that's a nice segue there. And it's worth pointing out that you also entertain. You do the Take This streams. Formally at this point with Dr. B, it was co-starring with you, I'm going to say. Now picking up with the lovely Dr. Sarah Hayes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What's that?
I was
like
singing as a parent. I'm also entertaining. But yes, as a streamer, yes.
That is well. Yeah, I mean, you do a great Russian accent as well. We heard that the other week.
That.
Like how do you find sort of like adding that? Because CMing is one thing, community management is one thing, but getting in front of a camera and like dissecting a game or playing a game, like that's I do it, and it's something extremely different.
So, I mean, getting in front of the camera, I just go back to my Griffball days. You know, I was streaming 3 times a week for probably 3 to 4 hours because that's how long games would last, maybe a little less than that. So being on Twitch and being on stream, not a big deal. Like, that's just what it is. In terms of looking at, say, representations of games, of mental health in games, like that's what I do for fun. So if I can just do it on camera and have other people talk about it, you know, if I'm playing through a game, I can't help, but you know, that lens never, it's like once you learn in design about Norman doors, which are the ones that have the pipe that is vertical and horizontal. So you never know whether you're supposed to push or pull. Mm-hmm. And once you know that like horizontal should be for push because that's the affordance and vertical is for pull because that's how we're ergonomically designed. Once you know that, you never unsee it. And it haunts you for the rest of your life. So congratulations, you're all indoctrinated into this now. So I think it goes back to the teaching thing is I love presenting. I love talking. I love educating. I love doing stuff like this where I get to talk about stuff that I am passionate about with other people who care about it. And so I think it doesn't feel like a performance. It just feels like it's me hanging out with people on stream. So I'm sure part of that is from all of the time I have spent streaming in my previous, you know, pre-doctoral life. And then a matter of, you know, it's not that different from teaching a class. It's a lot more fun, but it's really not that different in terms of like the educational component. And again, the therapist-y stuff comes in handy too, because boy, do I know how to keep a conversation going if somebody else isn't talking. I'm very good at that, and nudging and like moving directions and trying to make things interesting and engaging.
Out of interest then, it's funny you mentioned that because I do a little bit of teaching as well. I'm contracted to do it. I enjoy the teaching, dislike market, separate conversation.
Hate marking.
But I had a peer observation, and one of the things that came out of that was like, I was told I present like I'm a stand-up comedian.
I'll take it.
Because, like, you know, like, it's very kind of conversational. I'll try and get people involved, that type of thing. So the question I'm framing is, like, what's your kind of go-to nudge? Because if I, like, ask a question, and I'm like, ooh, okay, tough room. You know, like, you're like a stand-up comedian. And then if they don't respond to me, I'm like, Lord, please make me an engaging, you know, class teacher kind of thing. Then they sort of all start giggling, and that gives someone the gusto to answer, and we can get a conversation going. Do you have any like go-to kind of like warm the room, warm the class kind of lines?
So I tend to crack jokes. So I probably would get a, you know, stand-up comedian evaluation as well if anybody had ever bothered to evaluate me as a teacher. Again, blows my mind, but hey, you know what?
Clearly
and
that good
so
you
that's part of it. Apparently. But the clinical skill of like rapport building as a clinician, it's literally my job to get people to like me. And to feel safe and to feel comfortable with me as a person. So I'm sure I draw on that just subconsciously. I don't even think about it. But then I also, you know, I am very lucky that the classes I get to teach are stuff that I am genuinely passionate about. So I teach games history and society, games research methods, and the psychology of video games. And I love those topics. I also love crafting slide decks that are gorgeous.
I was going to mention this.
And so I think that's part of it too, is even if no one has anything to say, I'm so excited about what I'm talking about that I don't care. Isn't this cool, guys? Look at this. Did you know that some of the oldest game tokens are from 5,000 years ago in Turkey, and they were in a burial mound with like a dead king because they were so important even that many thousands of years ago that people literally were buried with their game tokens? How cool is that? And if there's crickets, I don't care because I think it's awesome. Like, and I'm delighted with myself.
Bury me with my Pokemon cards, you know?
Like, yeah. But if I am feeling stuck, I will, again, very therapist-y, I'll ask a question, and not like a factual question, but more of a reflective kind of reading the room type of question of, all right, so, you know, we've been talking for a little bit about X subject, and I would really like to hear from you all, you know, what are your thoughts? Does, you know, whether this makes sense or not, do you agree or not, you know, or if there's something specific, like, well, tell me about a time when you had something similar happen, because everybody has their own experience to draw from. So, like, you know, tell me about a time when you were playing a game and how it made you feel. And what was the last game you played and what feeling came out of playing that? And then as the last resort go-to, when I'm, because I teach game design, actually, I've never taught a psychology class. I've only taught game design classes. I always can default to, okay, so you guys all know I'm a psychologist, and I'm going to ask the therapist, how does this make you feel? And that typically breaks ice, and they're like, okay, she's joking, she's chill with it. That's always a good go-to as well.
So I clearly must be doing something right. You know, blush on me, oh, let's take it up another notch. You are known on the circuit as the patron saint of beautiful slides.
I am, yes.
How's that? How's that make you feel? Because you do some amazing slides. It's worth saying.
I love my slide decks. I genuinely do. It's one of those things where the visual, like I know as a psychologist, you know, that images can convey so much more quickly than words can. And so that's something that I'm always keeping in mind is like, is there a visual way to represent things? And so when I'm talking about games, it's really easy because games are made of visuals. Like there are, you know, whether it's a screenshot or, you know, a Steam post about the game, or maybe there's a dev blog that has like the layout of the narrative breakdown. Like so much of game and design is visual that it makes for really great visual slides. And then I enjoy a challenge of, here's this abstract concept that I don't have a picture for, but I need to find some way of like representing it. And I know Dr. Rachel Coert, I helped her with her slide deck for GDC, and there was she was talking about extremism and gaming platforms and something about like, we need to move away from decentralized moderation to a more unified whatever. And I'm like, Rachel, I don't know what that means. And so she broke it down and explained it to me. And I'm like, oh, it's whack-a-mole. And so I put whack-a-mole on her side, and she's like, that's exactly it. So like that creative spark moment of connecting a visual to like the thing in my head is something that I it's like a drug, like a really good drug. It sparks all my dopamine. There you go. I'm going to take a shot. I said dopamine. And then it's pretty. And so it helps that I have the design background, because then I have design fundamentals, and I also have the psychology background to know, okay, you don't want to put this much text. Or if you do, like the person's going to read the bold first, and then they'll read the medium, and then they'll read the light font, and they're going to read from left to right. And so you want to design your slides in a way that, you know, it's easy to digest. And as I've told Rachel, if people can learn everything of your talk from your slides, then they don't need you. The slides are not the presentation. The slides are the visual aids that reinforce and support your points. Like you are the star. You are the reason people are showing up. The slides are just there to make it visually engaging while people are auditorily engaging. And I will say it's hard. Like I get stressed out. I go through the creative process of like, hey, I'm doing great. And then I go into the pit of despair of like, all these slides are crap and my presentation is crap and I hate everything and I can't do this. And I slowly start to like, okay, I guess it's functional. Oh God, it's still shitty, but it's okay. We're getting better. And then I come up the other end of like, okay, you know what? It's okay. It's okay. I did the thing. And if I give time and look back and go, you know, that was a good deck, but it is definitely that creative process. At least for me.
So I obviously, you know, I have some kind of like general notes that I kind of look at for questions and stuff. I feel like we've covered a lot of ground, but I want to be respectful of your time. So I'm going to sort of like skip ahead a little bit. But the first thing I want to sort of say is like, you know, if you, and I speak to a lot of research people, but not always research people, and you kind of hinted at it before, but if you had like access to unlimited resources and no limitations, what would be the like the project you do? You mentioned your game. I assume you hire a team of people and make that triple A awesome.
Yeah. I mean, I literally, if I could find somebody who can code, and if I can find an artist, and probably sound, like if I'd want it to be nice, like I would need a team that can do that, because I can do all of those things, but not well. So yeah, if I had unlimited time and resources and funds, I would take that game that I've been working on. Because I think it, I mean, I've had people play test it and they really like it. And I think it would be really fun. And it's just a really fun game. And guess what? It's a game about mental health. Shocking. It's the Ace Attorney series, but instead of an attorney, you're a therapist. And instead of a human, you're a dog. And all your clients are also dogs, and you help them with their puppy problems. And it allows you to encroach on some of the difficult conversations in therapy from an abstract perspective. So you don't have to worry about someone playing your game and thinking they're a therapist, because you're literally talking about, you're drooling too much when the mailman rings the doorbell. So, but yeah, I would work on that.
Shut up and take my money. Where can I pre-order it? I want this in my life like right now.
It's a good idea. And I wish I had time to do it, but dev is hard. And like making a game is one of the most expensive, most difficult things you can possibly do. So I would, you know, if I win the lottery, then I'll pay off my student loans and then still be poor. if I won the second lottery though, that's what I would do.
Yeah. So much debt. You need to win the lottery twice.
Yes.
Okay. Fair. I mean that.
America.
That sounds incredible, to be fair. And I think it would just, because obviously, because I know you're making it, like I know it would really, it have so much nuance that would make it even more amazing, you know? But just like, even like that as a basic premise sounds hilarious. Like, you know, who did the doodle on the carpet? You've got to interrogate them, find out. You could, like, there's so much you could do with that.
I mean, I think one of my favorite things about it is in the version I made for my master's thesis, again, very janky, very unstable, not really playable outside of me like standing over watching, as all games start.
Yeah.
There was a moment where in between clients, her name's Ellie, after my dear Ellie, my Ellie Beagle. And the therapist goes to a restaurant and she's sitting down and she's having lunch. And all of a sudden she sees one of her clients. And it presents the player with the question, do you go over and say hi? Do you stay, you know, do you eat your lunch and just ignore them? Or do you get up and leave?
Oh, can I answer this one? Can I answer it? Yeah. So
yeah.
Maybe it's just how we do things over here, but the way is that therapists would not like come and say hi to you, but if you acknowledge them, they would say hi. Like, so you, they so would have to go over to the therapist. Okay.
Yes. Yep. Well, what the funny part that I found fascinating is that the psychologists that I had played, they all, 100% of them, chose to go talk to the client. And all the game dev people I had chose to leave. And it's the perfect example of why when we're in games, we are exploring spaces. Because the psychologists, they know, the therapists know that you would never go up to a client in real life. And so what they're doing is they're playing with the game space. They're playing with the rules of this universe of, well, what would happen if, because they know the right answer. They know. Whereas the game dev students were like, oh my God, this feels like a really big, scary moment. And I'm going to do the most conservative thing possible because I don't know what to do. And so I'm going to protect myself.
Yeah.
And so it was wild watching those two different professions play in two different ways. And yeah, the therapists absolutely were like, I'm going to go talk to my client, Mr. Toots. He's right over there and I'm going to see what happens. And of course it gets incredibly awkward because he's there with his friend. And now it's like, oh, who are you? How do you know this person? How do you two know each other? Like, wait a minute, what's going on? And it gets really, really awkward, really, really fast. And that's really satisfying for the clinicians because they're like, yes, that's why we don't do it.
All I can imagine is some type of like BoJack Horseman, kind of like Mr. Peanut Butter kind of entry. Like, hey, look, Timothy, it's me. Is this a crossover episode? Like some like really like hurt your soul kind of cringeworthy. Like,
yes. Yes. I mean, the first character is a yellow lab, and he is absolutely 100% modeled off of Mr. Peanut Butter.
But with no copyright infringement. Absolutely. His name is
Mr. Toots.
Yeah, so. Totally different lab. If you've met one, you've met all.
Different. Yeah. Yellowish. Not even a yellow lab, just yellowish. Excellent. Mr. Nutella. Mr. Nut Spread. Oh, no, not that one. Throw that one away. That one's gone. We'll stay with Mr. Toots.
I'm pretty sure that's on a different type of website.
Yep, not here. Keeping it clean.
Moving swiftly on. Do you have like anyone who you'd sort of like to give a shout out to, so like an inspirational person, org, or figures? Just because I think, again, we spoke a lot like what you do, maybe why you do it, but you know, I'm going to say flirted with you and been like, your work is amazing, it inspires me. But I think we can sometimes forget like the people that have helped us get to where we are, also people that inspired us to put us on those paths. So I like to pose that question of like, is there an inspirational person or figure or figures that you'd like to give a little shout out to and give them a little nod?
I mean, I have to give a shout out to my Take This team. So Dr. Rafael Bakamatsu, Dr. Sarah Hayes, and Dr. Rachel Cowart, who are just like, they're a family. We're, you know, we're just cheesy, not in work family, because work family is bad.
No,
do that. But like us as peers, that goes very much to the like not feeling so alone. And I don't know if I could have kept going down this path if I had stayed as lonely as I was when I first graduated. So huge shout out to them. I have to give a shout out to the OG, Jay McGonigal. Her book, Reality is Broken, came out in 2009. And that's the year I started my doctoral program. It was the very first anything that I'd ever read that said that maybe games weren't evil. Mm-hmm. It was the first research I had ever come across that said that maybe games can be done for a benefit. And so that that literally changed my entire focus, because I was just going to bring my capstone with me of like games and violence, because that's all you could do at that point. And so reading her book, I was like, wait a minute, I don't have to do this games and violence nonsense. I can actually look at the positives and the benefits. Like, there is a path out there. So I think that's, I will jealously brag, I guess. I got to work with her on a game that she made. So that's kind of like a little feather in my hat there. So again, I can't understate like the impact that her work had on me knowing that I could exist in this space. And then there have been a couple professors who, even if they didn't know what I was doing, they were supportive. So like the chair of my dissertation, he, you know, I think he'd played Zelda, but he didn't consider himself a gamer, but he at least knew that what games were. And he was so supportive when nobody else wanted to work with me because they were so afraid of like, oh, we don't know what games are. It's scary stuff. So huge shout out to him. In my game design program, all of my professors, so Lindsay Grace and Mike Trainer and Josh, of course, I'm putting Josh's last name at this moment. Josh McCoy. And Ben Stokes, when he came in, and Chris Totten, that was the crew that I had when I was going through my grad school program. And they were just so like, that's how I got to my first GDC. That's how I started getting on like major stages, going to Games for Change and doing stuff like this, because these professors believed in what I could do and were like, hey, we're going to help you get there. And I owe so much to them. And then, I could keep going and going, but huge, Heidi McDonald, another wonderful human being, Kat Wendt, my friend Trin. I could go on and on. There's so many people who inspire me.
It's your stage, like, you know.
And so I will be incredibly honest. This is probably the most anxiety provoking question for me. And I can feel like my clinical levels of anxiety rising. And this is why I never participate in those Twitter threads of like, hey, give people a shout out, because I am so overcome with anxiety that I'll forget someone and that they'll feel bad. That it's almost crippling. So if I've never responded to one of those, that's why, because that's my own process that I work through, which is why this question is so hard. Cause I would never want to leave someone out and have them feel bad. But again, that's my own. I need to talk with my therapist about that.
No, that's fair. It is just, it's just meant to be an opportunity to celebrate the people who have uplifted. You know, I think it, I may therapizing? I don't know, but I feel like, that level of like passion and support kind of comes through, I think, like from yourself. Because I think one of the things I noticed was like the level of support and encouragement people in the space have given me, just like walking through the door and everyone be like, hey, as opposed to get out, which is kind of what you get in a lot of fields, to be honest.
Especially academia, yeah.
Yeah, like that level of support like is something that when you sort of see that thing and go, oh, I can't do that. And people go, no, you give it a go though, have a shot and go, yeah, go on, I will. I mean, that's, so my entire visit to PAX was, I'm going to procrastinate because I theoretically can do this. And then, you know, panels got approved and I was like, oh, uh-oh, this is actual work now. Uh-oh.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, got to just work with, you know, all my heroes and heroines. So it was a banger time, really, but all good. But yeah, like that, like encouragement and support, I think is really prominent in like the game studies crew. I'm reticent to use the word family because, as you say, like work family is not a good, that's
yeah,
a red flag.
It's a weird thing. Crew, I like crew. Club, can we be a football club?
Game Studies Football Club.
Okay.
Yes.
Game Studies FC.
Yes. That, I mean, and that you know, that I can truly get behind. It is something that really resonates. As we sort of begin to wind down towards the end of the episode, I like to do a totally not knocked off thing from Desert Island Discs, where you're going on a retreat. You decide you've won a breakaway by yourself, and you can take a few items with you. I know, right? Precious,
I'm a parent. The idea of alone time is like
scarcity. Am I right? Scarcity. And to take with you, you are allowed to take one film. Or TV series, I'm flexible. One album, you know, one book, and one video game. If it sort of comes in a set or collection, I'm lenient. I'll let you have like the set.
Oh, good.
But what would you take with you? And you can go wherever you want. It's not just a desert island. Because I, for one, would not go to a desert island. I would perhaps go somewhere nice and Arctic or rural and foresty.
I'm going to go with forest, like woods and mountains, because, again, the skin not meant for the sun.
Feel that.
Yep, I'm in good company. But theoretically, okay, so let's see here. Books. I'll start with a book series. How long am I gone? Because I have like a long series and a short series. And I like them both.
You are there for several months, say. Long enough to enjoy it.
Oh, God. Okay. So books, I would probably do Name of the Wind by Patrick Rothfuss. I think that collection of books is, I'm still waiting for the next one to come out, but they're each like 1200 pages long and he can't really write women characters, but the rest of it's really good. So, you know, that's,
well, a male author that can't write female characters, calling me surprised.
I know, it's shocking. It's shocking. But the world he creates is so good that I'm willing to like overlook that.
Okay.
So that would be the book. Film, I mean, my first thought, if I just go with my instinct, it would probably be the Lord of the Rings trilogy. One, because that would take up a lot of time.
What cut are you really taking?
Oh, the theatrical. I don't need Tom Bombadil in my life. Okay. I will stand by that.
All right. And what are your feelings on The Hobbit? And I ask that because I've had a previous guest say The Lord of the Rings, and I brought The Hobbit up and they were very offended and do not believe it should be part of the canonical cinematic universe.
I have no strong feelings. I heard the production set was really awful and like the working conditions were not great. So that makes me kind of angry on behalf of it, but I haven't watched it and I don't intend on watching it. So I don't really have strong feelings either way.
Ambivalent. Fair. I'll take it.
Ambivalent. Album. So my favorite album is probably American Idiot by Green Day.
Nice.
Cause I am a child of the 90s and the early aughts. And what video game? Halo. Right now I'm playing Halo Infinite and it is a lot of fun.
Little bit of a tricky one for you though. Would you take Infinite or would you take the Master Chief Collection that has everything up to that point?
So I would take Infinite because then I could play with my friends. Because even though like seclusion on a desert island sounds wonderful, I am a social being and I need some kind of connection. So I would choose Infinite because that's how me and my friends play. We have a standing Saturday play date and I would choose that.
I think you're like the first guest to ever sort of make that type of connection because a lot of people go like, yeah, I think I had someone who said they would take their Animal Crossings and restart their island wouldn't do multiplayer, people would be like, yeah, I'm going to take the longest game that has the widest range of replayability so I can just stick my head into it kind of thing. So an excellent take. I'm glad that you have that admission of being a social creature. And I yes. respect it. And yeah,
I would miss my babies. I would not miss sleeping, you know, not very much, but I would miss my babies. And so I would definitely want to be able to chat with them as well.
No, that's fair. I mean, you can always frame it in the context of it's a working sabbatical. So it's like everyone's getting a nice breakaway. But, you know, let's live with the fantasy. Let's enjoy it as it is.
All right. You know? I will. I'm going to hold on to that visual image. A cool mountain. I'm thinking like Lake Tahoe, early spring. Yes. Jet skis in the afternoon. Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. I'm going to hold on to that.
Oh, yeah. Let that see you through your next, you know, wave in the ocean, if you will. As we get to sort of the very end of the written questions, at least, because I'm happy for you to keep chatting to me. Why would I not be? Do you have any questions for me? I like to turn the tables upon myself and give my guests the chance to ask something. I've already had the what would I take, I think, at least twice now. I can't remember. So that's maybe one to avoid. Any other questions? Wait.
Okay. I guess in your ideal world, you know, again, I had this ideal of like the trifecta of teaching, designing, and doing therapy. What's kind of your marker of like, you know, this would be a huge point for me to reach?
Oof, that's a great question. Honestly, I don't know. I'm kind of, so everyone who knows me is going to go, what is he chatting? Because they know I'm the most cynical, dark-hearted, ground-down human that there is in existence. But, like, I feel like in terms of what I want to do with my career, I'm still very, like, optimistically puppy-like in that I've got research I want to do, and I would like to do that psychotherapeutic training and maybe game design. I understand they're maybe going to be harder to tick off the boxes. I genuinely didn't expect to like teaching as much as I did. I really kind of like, I'm going to fell in love with it. But I hate like guest lecturing. Perfect. Cause no marketing and bureaucracy can get out the window. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. but you know, and I'd also love to like work in something to do with games like UX or UR or, you know, like just, you know, being involved in that process. If it's like a mental health story or something. I always say like, I'm not necessarily creative, but I'm great at like reorganizing the jigsaw pieces a little bit that might help someone else.
Okay.
You know, sometimes you got to shake the box up to find a piece you want. I might not be able to give you the piece, but I can maybe help you find it. So I really don't know. There's so much that I want to do. Like I mentioned my colleague before, and like the idea of doing stuff together is like genuinely exciting. I'm like, yeah, we're going to tear up this research. It's going to be boss. And like, you know, speaking at PAX was like incredible. There was something like so cathartic, obviously being around one's people, but also like, you know, I enjoyed that bit of speaking in front of an audience and, you know, getting them to cheer and stuff. And it's incredibly flattering when people are coming to me of all people for like answers to questions afterwards, something that's very dopamine releasing about that. Another shot, everyone, you know? So yeah, I want it all. And I want it in like a year and a half when I've done this PhD.
Okay. One of those is realistic. One of them, maybe we're in the time frame a little bit, but you know, yeah.
Wait, which one's that? I'm curious.
Oh, I thought you said you want it all and you want it in the next year and a half.
Oh, no. I want it in a year and a half when I finish the PhD. Like, no sooner, please.
Okay.
That'd be too much.
Oh, no sooner. Okay. I was like, that's ambitious. That's good.
No.
Okay. Gotta
finish the PhD. That's top of the hit list.
Yes.
If my supervisor listening, it's definitely top of the hit list. That's all I'm doing all the time.
Okay. And I guess my last question is, when am I getting invited to the cyber psychology meet and greet that you guys host? Like,
when,
I've been stood up for that a few times.
So there's one like every sort of like couple of months, because I'm the acting cyber psychology rep. So you can come hang with some other angry postgrads, basically all saying that we don't get paid enough. That's totally cool. I could probably like organize something slightly more formal with lots of people who would be interested to hear about your career through my connections at SciPack. That would be something they would enjoy immensely, I would bet. Okay. So we can meet, okay. We easily make that happen with lickety split, no worries, easy money. You know, I'll just, I'll mention your name and everyone will just like lose their hats and be like, you're joking. And I'm like, no, I have connections. It's fine.
Please video that. I would like to see everyone lose their hats.
Metaphorical hats, obviously.
I need citations here.
Right,
right, right.
You know, like, don't bother wearing socks.
Of course, as always, I am teasing.
I mean, it's...
I'm teasing, but if there were to be an invitation, I would gladly accept. Just, you know, this is how I got my husband to propose to me, is I found a book that had, like, rings in it, and I circled, and I said, you know, Kelly would like this one. And then the year prior, we were at the 4th of July at the Jefferson Memorial, and I'm like, you know what? This would be a perfect place to get married, because someone right in front of us proposed and had that happen to them. And I basically, like, you know, was just very clear about, hey, if you want this to happen, I'm not asking, I'm just saying...
Listen,
if this is something that you'd like to have,
I like to think I'm an empathetic, compassionate person who does all the psychology and stuff. But let me tell you, everyone listening, that type of stuff is very helpful, okay? You're going to save a lot of faffing about. Like, a lot of faffing about. I'm telling you right now, everyone listening, do that for your partners. Just let them know exactly what you want so they can't go wrong. You're laughing.
I mean, if I know this is off topic and maybe a good thing to end on, maybe, I don't know. But my husband and I have something called the obvious fairy, which any time around Father's Day or Mother's Day or his birthday or my birthday or Christmas, an exchange of gifts, he miraculously gets an email from an email account called the obvious fairy, which informs him of the things that I would like and where he can find them and what size, if that's appropriate, and what color, if that's also appropriate. And, you know, since the obvious fairy came into our life, it's been pretty good.
Is that an actual web service, or did you just make it through email? Okay. Cause that would be an absolutely amazing web service. Get on that.
Yeah. So, you know, possible venture capitalist idea. I claim royalties. But no, it is an email account, the obvious fairy that drops into his email to let him know, like, hey, you know, Kelly would really like this pair of earrings off of Etsy, or she'd really love that stuffed goose game goose that has the magnet in its beak so it can hold sharp objects. And look here, so you can find it. And this is the size that she'd like it in.
Maximum goose size, largest possible goose.
I mean, of course.
Yeah.
Largest possible goose.
Yeah.
Yes. Maximum give me the largest goose you have. Maximum goose. Yeah. That's going to have to be an emote. I'm going to have to figure out how to make that for Twitch. Maximum goose.
Just like a goose with a big wingspan in it.
Big wingspan.
Just like, yeah. Maximum
big
goose.
Bold text. Maximum goose. Yes. I like it.
Or Super Saiyan goose also works. You know, we've all been there.
Kamehameha. I'm like, Kamehameha goose? No, that doesn't work. We'll workshop it. We'll keep working on that.
Keep an eye out for this emote in the Take This Twitch channel, because it's going to happen.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But like in regards to like the obvious fairy, like, I mean, I just, whenever there's like a Christmas or something, I always just like do a wish list from a popular web service and go, this is basically the things that I would want. If you find them anywhere at a better price, like an independent bookshop or something, buy it there. But just like, this is basically the thing, because, like, you know, you can see I've got a lot of collectibles. So a lot of the time people go, mm-hmm. Oh, I know Chris likes this thing, but I don't know if he owns it. So I just like, yeah. So there'll just be like 10 pop figures. It's like, you know, you pick any one of them, I'm going to be a happy boy. So.
Perfect.
You know.
It's a version of the obvious fairy. It's the obvious gnome, maybe?
Sure.
Some other fae creature.
So if you've listened all the way to this episode and you've reached this point, you've got everything from life advice that you could imagine to everything else. We've hit every bit that we could possibly ask for. Which is
and we haven't talked about parenting, but that's okay. You gotta save something, you know, you gotta hold something in reserve for next time.
Yeah. That for me would be a departure for the show, given I know nothing about parenting other than having been a child.
That's some experience.
I have a perspective. I don't, you know, but it's not a good one. Do you know what I mean?
Oh boy, okay. All right, therapist hat time. Okay.
But, you know, okay, so where is the best place for people to find you?
So the two places I am most often, one is Twitter, and that's at Kelly N, N Dunlap, and my last name, and I'm sure it'll be in the show notes. I am on Twitter all the time. I love meeting new people on Twitter, so please do not feel shy. I will be happily follow or message back if you have questions. I love, again, this circle of people who have shared interest. It's good that it is growing, and I'm happy to help facilitate that. The other place that you can always find me is the Take This Discord. So that is discord.gg/taketthisorg. I am the community manager there. So my name will be in purple. It'll say CM on it. And again, if you want to go there to hang out and enjoy the community, you can DM me via Discord. Like I'm very open. All my DMs are open. And I'm happy to field questions in a more professional capacity. I do have my professional website, which is Dunlap Psyd, so DunlapPsyd, because I was not thinking at all when I made that website in terms of names or having to tell people what the site is. But there you can find my presentations, my papers, work that I've done. There's a contact form if you want to get at me that way.
Get at me.
Yeah, those are probably the three best places to find me.
All of those will be attached to wherever you found this podcast episode, for sure. All those links. I mean, the Take This Discord is like, I mean, obviously I'm there as well, because of course I am. But it's like legitimately great. The Therameme section is by far the best in any. I mean, I also quite like puns. I know you're not quite as fan of them. But we'll leave that way. Let's not end on a sour note. With anything less, though, let me just say, Kelly, thank you so much for joining me on the show. I've appreciated it so much. I've been psyched to sort of know you as a professional since I did. And then even more psyched to have you sit down and join me for this little... what do you call it? Everything's a fireside chat now, isn't it? Yeah, why not? So thank you so much. I will flick over to the ending screen for our video... entrepreneurs. But otherwise, thank you everyone for watching and listening, taking part. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'll see you again next time. Until then, look after your mind, body, and soul. Take it easy. Well, thank you so much for listening to another episode of Psyched to Be With You. I really hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. As ever, if you did enjoy it, please leave a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. It really, really helps. If you want to keep up with all things Blind Psyche, check out the episode description for a link, or you can go direct to linktr.ee/blindpsyche. Thank you so much for listening. As ever, look after your mind, body, and soul, and I will see you again very, very soon. Bye-bye.